Welcome to another episode of the People Will Talk podcast. Joining me in studio is Maria. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. What about you?
I'm very good, thank you. And special guest Joe Rossiter. How are you, Joe?
Not too bad at all, thank you. How are you guys?
Pretty good, yeah. It's Halloween night, so we're full of expected candy, we'll find out from the neighbours over the course of the evening afterwards. So, Joe, it's a pleasure having you here. Thank you so much for being here. And we've so much that we want to ask you about. You're a man of many talents.
Maybe, geez, I don't know about that.
You're doing yourself a disservice, I'm sure. For our international audience, maybe we can start with the cycling, because when foreigners think of Ireland and sports, they usually think we're rubbish at all sports, but that's not the case. But they don't know that we actually have a strong tradition in cycling, and you have a strong interest and passion for cycling as well. Is that because you're Irish? You grew up with maybe a time when Irish riders were dominating the sports, or is there another reason why you fell in love with the sport of cycling?
Wow, well, that's a loaded question. There's a lot going on. I guess a lot of it has to do with my age. I got involved in cycling. I got a BMX bike for Christmas in 1981, and ET came out the following year. So all of a sudden, BMX bikes were super fashionable, and everybody had one, and I did a lot of cycling. And then simultaneously, we had a club here in the village I live in. And they were starting into racing, and I got into racing, and it was the time, as you said a minute ago, that Sean Kelly, Stephen Roach, all the big hitters were starting to win in Europe and do very, very well. So I actually grew up at a time when, well, I suppose you went with the wave of cycling, and it was probably the biggest sport in Ireland in the 1980s, I imagine. It kind of goes in waves anyway, but for about 10 years it was huge, and everybody cycled. But I guess actually, my brother would have a lot to do with it, and my family, in that my brother got into cycling before me. He would have been a racing cyclist, and he would have loved all the Tour de France. He studied French in college, so he was mad into Bernard Hinault and Laurent Fignon and all these famous guys. And he used to get magazines of all the French races, and it looked incredible, and it kind of instilled the love of the whole thing in me. Plus, my family, my dad would have been a runner. He would have been Leinster champion in the 40s and stuff like that. And his brother would have been a cyclist. They all cycled to events. So there was always some sort of cycling or something going on in the family, or some sort of endurance event. And then all my brothers and sisters were all either cyclists or runners or whatever. So it was actually, I couldn't really get away from cycling, really. I just jumped in on the wave, I guess, that was going through my household, I suppose, and the country in the 1980s, really.
Wow. You mentioned the magazines, because nowadays we have ESPN, Sky Sports, seeing hurling in Azerbaijan or something, it's something that's very accessible. So back then, seeing these magazines, was it something very exotic? Was it like a window into another world, Was it something very enticing?
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose Stephen had an absolute love. That's my brother, had an absolute love for France. And even he used to go off and volunteer in the summer. He had to do French as part of his, obviously, degree. He had to spend some time there, but he used to go and work in a charity called Le Petit Frère in France every summer, and basically bring home magazines. You couldn't get anything like that in Ireland. It was all in French. And I mean, my French was non-existent. So it was all about the pictures and the images. And it did look like it was so attractive and so beautiful. And obviously, we didn't really, I suppose, in Ireland, hurling and football were a big thing, and rugby was around, but the photography and the media around that just wasn't up to par with what media was around cycling, I think, in Europe. Cycling was such an established thing for probably 50 years in Europe at this stage, so there was a minus amount of books and magazines and stuff to go with it, whereas sport in Ireland didn't really catch up with that. And now obviously media has really picked up. I mean, you go to any event now and there's so many photographs online and everything, it's caught up. But back then, yeah, it was something exotic, and it was far away, it was something very beautiful. Obviously there were the best shots, and the sun was shining, and France looked amazing in July and whatever. So, obviously, yeah. And same thing, I suppose, for me, it would have been the Tour of Spain then, or the Tour of Italy. We don't have mountains like that. We don't have snow like that. We don't have, 35 degrees like that. So it looked absolutely beautiful,
That was really nice, Joe, because actually I don't know very much about cycling at all. But my father used to make us watch, you know, the Tour de France for the landscapes. He would always say, "Oh, very good." Because he was from the north of Spain, like me, very close to the Pyrenees, and he used to go with his parents, you know, in the early 50s as a kid, and knew all the French, you know, cyclists. And so, funnily enough, what you just explained really evoked some memories of the things that my dad used to tell me growing up.
There's so many amazing Spanish writers that, you know, I mean, when I grew up, it was Pedro Delgado was the guy that was the problem for Stephen Rush. So, like, it was, you know, Spanish writers were amazing. And, you know, what's it called? So I suppose, you know, living in Ireland, which is quite rural, I think, or very parochial, it's mad to know, like, who Pedro Delgado was and that he was from Segovia and whatever, you know, whereas I didn't know who my local footballer was or my local herder or where they came from, you know.
Yeah, no, that's really nice. I was so surprised that you say that. Very nice. But we also, I know you were in something called a B development squad. Now, you have to enlighten us, you know, for as people that don't know that much about cycling, because I gather this is a big deal. Something to do with the Olympics. Tell us a bit more, just, you know, for the benefit of the Spanish listeners.
Cool. Well, look, unfortunately, it's not as good as it sounds. When you guys were talking about this, I thought, do you know, the more I thought about it, the more disappointing it actually is as a thing in my life. But look, so in 1999, I'd been in Spain for 2 years, and I'd come home, and I'd actually done a lot of cycling when I was in Spain. I wasn't doing well as a teacher over there. I wasn't earning a lot of money. So I bought a secondhand bike in, I can't remember there's shops that sell a lot of secondhand stuff over there. I can't remember what it was, but anyway, I bought a bike and I cycled a lot. I went to Casa de Campo and cycled a hell of a lot, and then I came home at the end of 99, and I was only working part-time in a local school, and I did a lot of cycling. Maybe I was cycling 500 kilometers a week and doing a lot of training. And then I ran into an old friend of mine who had a bike shop in Dublin, and he was saying, "Oh, what are you doing?" And I said, "I'm just doing a bit of cycling and working part-time." And he said, "Look, why don't you go for some tests?" There was the Irish Cycling Federation at the time were doing physiological tests. So I went for a physiological test with him, and it turned out that I was relatively fit. I think they were looking for they were trying to put together a group of between 15 and 20 riders. And basically what happened was the following year was going to be an Olympic year, and they had a lot of cyclists that were being trained and looked after. So they needed other riders in Ireland that were, you know, not the top guys, but like basically trying to develop them, trying to bring them on. I was getting quite old at that stage for a cyclist. I was heading for 30, and I did okay in the tests, and basically said, "Well, look, come on now. You can train over the winter, and then we'll see how you go next year." So I had a big celebration with my family. I thought this was fantastic. My God, I'm actually doing well as a cyclist. And unfortunately, what happened was I didn't get any really coaching help. I was basically told I was part of a group, and back then everything was done by letter. I think I got one letter from the federation in the whole time that I was training for them. So for about 6 months, I was training as hard as I could, and basically the idea was to see how well you would race the following year. So in the first race of the year, which was St. Patrick's Day, I got 10th or 11th in a race which had all the big hitters in Ireland, pretty damn good, the big names, and I did very well, and I was very happy. And what happened was, about a week later, the federation decided that they didn't have the funding for a B development squad. So the first 9 or 10 guys were going to be looked after, but they didn't have any funding or coaching or money to look after the second group. And I was definitely in the second group. I wasn't the best cyclist in the country. So basically, they just lost interest. They stopped putting any interest into the whole thing. And this was going into April in 2000. And I put my heart and my soul into it for the whole winter. And then I got sick. I got a chest infection. I was training very, very hard, and I probably wasn't looking after myself the best. I got a chest infection. And so at the same time I got a chest infection, they pulled the plug, and basically there was no B development squad. Like, so the A guys went on, but the B guys didn't. And that was me. That was me finished with the whole Irish cycling program. So what I did then, for, you know, I was kind of out of the loop. And for the next few years, I cycle and trained very, very hard. I raced well, but I never got back into any sort of national development squad or any. I never got any help from the Irish Cycling Federation ever again, really. That was it. So it was kind of a disappointing thing because I put a lot into it. But at the same time, I think it actually spurred me on to train harder and to do better. So I actually ended up racing pretty much, geez, that was 2000, pretty much till 2017, 2018, I probably raced every year and did okay. I was always up there, had a couple of wins, won a couple of leagues and stuff. But yeah, it was a catalyst. But at the same time, at the time in early 2000, it was extremely disappointing. And I lost the head. I was like very, very disappointed. And, I kind of put a lot of work in and then they weren't interested in putting any work in themselves. And so from that point of view, I suppose it was really good in that it was a catalyst for the rest of my cycling for the next number of years. But at the time, it was actually a very disappointing experience.
It sums up Irish sports, it's a shambles, really, because even you look at how they look after football these days and there's not any investment in grassroots football or in the League of Ireland, So there's countries the size of Ireland who dominate sports because they get proper support financially and also looking after athletes. So going back to the year 2000, it was 23 years ago, probably attitudes back then were very different. Professionalism was very different, probably in most countries regarding sport, and things have come on a long way. But even so, hearing how you just got one letter from the Federation is very surprising and disappointing, because talent, even if the talent never makes it all the way to the Olympics or the World Cup or whatever it is, like, they should be given a proper go of it and proper nurturing. And I think for a lot of people, and you'd be an example of that as well, like that wasn't the case. So it's just very frustrating to hear your story, to be honest with you.
Absolutely. But I also feel that I think you hit the nail on the head there. I think, Ireland is funny, isn't it, in that you throw an Irish boxer into the Olympics and they're probably going to get a medal, and they've come from nowhere and got no help. And we always seem to, pardon the pun, but we do tend to punch above our weight in all sorts of sports. Realistically, we come from, not that we come from nothing, but there, as you said, there's no support there. And then all of a sudden, we pop up and we do quite well occasionally. Even the rugby in Ireland at the moment is, the funding in Irish rugby compared to English rugby is non-existent. The guys are professional, but, the funding's not there. So for us to get as far as we did and say the Rugby World Cup is incredible, or for the boxers to show up in the Olympics or a runner to do quite well or get into a final, it's despite the lack of interest from Irish funding and Irish sports in general, isn't it, really?
It's just a pity, because if you look at the Olympics as well, whoever spends the most money gets the most medals. It's financial doping. That's a term we hear in football a lot now because of all the big countries buying football clubs. But it's also a fact in the Olympics that the British and the Americans would financially back their teams, and that's why they come away with a lot of medals. And obviously in Ireland, that's not always realistic given the size of the country, but there's definitely room, yeah, I'd say, for them to do better. But it's interesting, all your racing, that's a great credit to you. It's very interesting to hear how you're racing for such a long time after that, and your good record in winning some of those competitions and stuff. I also wanted to ask you about your relationship with the bike in a more professional context as well. Because the Olympics, of course, is amateur. The athletes aren't paid. But you also work as a courier. And, I think that's a job that has a lot of stories contained within it. So I'd like to ask you about that. So that's the first question linked to that. But also the second question would be, nowadays with YouTube, there's a lot of people who actually film themselves making deliveries of food and packages and things like that. And I follow one of them. And for me, it's very interesting content. But so the second question would be linked to this would be, what do you think is the attraction for people to watch couriers on YouTube? So the first question is, what are your mad stories, I guess? And then secondly, why are people watching in 2023 on YouTube people doing courier jobs,
Okay, well, geez, I don't know how much time you have, but we might be here till tomorrow. So it's actually funny then. My bike messenger thing started as a needs must. I was in college, I ended up doing a night degree in the early 90s, and it was, so basically I had to pay my own way, and I needed a job. So I wasn't qualified at Anton, unfortunately. It was a catch 22, wasn't it? Because I hadn't finished college, I wasn't qualified, and because I wasn't qualified, I couldn't get many jobs. And then all of a sudden, there's a couple of people from County Wexford, where I live here, that were involved in as bike messengers in different companies, and they said, listen, give it a try. And obviously I love cycling, so I said I would, but I was completely green. I've written a couple of blogs about this. Like, I was so green, I didn't know Dublin. I lived in Dublin for what do you call it, 7 years straight. So for the first years from 92 onwards, I didn't know my way around. I was a country boy, really. And so the first time I got a job as a bike messenger, I was told I had a job on Friday and I was starting on Monday, and I went off and I bought a city map, and I literally rode around Dublin city trying to remember and memorize street names, the, you know, laneways, all that sort of stuff, stupid stuff. And of course, literally first day, first shout on the radio was, I was in Stephen's Green, and I was told to go pick up a package in a particular street, and I went off to pick it up, and then I realized around the corner that I was going the wrong direction. So all the guys that I was working with, I had passed by them, and they laughed and they gave me a round of applause, and you know, that kind of thing. So I started off really stupid and really, really, really ignorant, unfortunately. And I thought, you know, physically I was up to it. And then, you know, logistically and mentally, it takes a little bit of time to get into it. You know, if you guys, when you go to a bar, and the barman is able to take three different orders from three different customers, and there's probably four different types of drinks in each order, you know, and you kind of go, oh my God, how can they do that? And the reality was, as a bike messenger, that's what you have to do. You get calls on the radio as you're cycling to a job, or picking up a job, or dropping off, and you're given two jobs while you're on the go. So you can't stop and write it down, because what happens is you're losing time. So the good guys are the guys that can remember it, like a barman, as you're moving, and you know, you're constantly rolling, and you're heading for one job, but you have in the back of your mind where the next job is, or what you can drop along the way. Or it's a crazy kind of job. But from that point of view, look, there's loads of different stories. Look, there's a seedy side to my time as courier, because a lot of guys were, there was a lot of bad things would have happened. You know, a lot of people I worked with, a couple of people are dead, to be fair. There was a drug culture in the first company I worked with. There was a lot of drugs at the weekend and stuff, and to the point where one lady that I started working with became addicted to, started off with amphetamines, and ended up, you know, she used to love ecstasy at the weekend, but it got to the point where she would need a amphetamine on a Friday to get her into the weekend, and then the last time I would have had a conversation with her, she would have needed amphetamines on a Monday to get her back into the week. And you know, then 2 years later she was dead. There's other stories like that as well. There is a seedy side to it. There's a funny side to it, in that there's crazy stories where people do silly things. You know, there's the guys who would pull mirrors off a taxi if a taxi you know, pulled across you or caused any problems. There was guys who there was one famous story of a guy who we used to do what we call the blood run. There's a group called Brief Couriers, and they used to pick up blood from Pelican House, which was the central point in Dublin city centre where blood was stored. And then if a phone call came in for a hospital needing, you know, type A blood as quick as possible, actually a bicycle courier was the fastest way to get it across the city. So one story that I actually thought was an urban myth until I was at a party a couple of years later and I actually met the guy who this had happened to. This guy picked up two bags of blood, and he was at Pelican House, flying down the canal, got to Buxar's, the bus centre in Dublin, and was going around a corner, and he hit an old lady walking across the road, and he ended up on the ground, but he landed on his back. So as he landed, the blood bags in his satchel bag behind him burst. So what happened was, he ended up lying on the ground, and he was a bit dazed and knocked out, but then he went to get up, and everybody rushed over and basically said, no, don't get up, you're bleeding, you're obviously you're often smashing your head open. So he was a bit dazed and he didn't know what they were going on about, and then he started to feel very wet, and he realised that the blood bags that were in the bag were often exploding in a fan all around him, and obviously he looked like a serious trauma case for that. So he was trying to get up, and he kept on saying, no, that's not my blood. And obviously everybody he was holding him down, they called an ambulance, they wouldn't let him get up, they thought he was demented. that was a really good but really bad story. Look, there's lots of other, I think what's wrong is, like, before I get to your second question, I think okay, in Dublin, and I've spoken to people who've done the job in London as well, I think that the actual thing is that it looks exciting and it's great fun, but actually you'll always have one story at the end of the week when you go to the pub on a Friday evening and you're laughing and joking about this or that. And reality is that, you know, 90% of your week is, I'm not going to call it drudgery, because I loved riding the bike and I loved the freedom, and it's just not, it's not even fresh air, because I mean, geez, in the winter the weather was horrendous. I mean, you know, I definitely I've had days where I lost the feeling in my fingers, people switched off the radios and went home, they just couldn't work, you know, it was horrible. But having said that, I love the idea of being outside and being the kind of freedom. You're not lawless, but you kind of feel, I don't know, it's not above the law either, but you just kind of feel, I don't know, there's something different about you when you're doing that kind of job. But the reality is it is a lot of drudgery and a lot of hard work. And but, you know, I suppose, so I started off with a company that would have done very long jobs from, if you know Dublin at all, it's like, you know, from, we're talking about from Houston Station to Ringsend, you got paid the same amount of money for that job as you got from, say, Stevens Green to the bottom of Grafton Street. You know, so you could get, you know, you could spend all day on these long jobs and be really bored and not very well paid. And then as you got better, you might change company and you'll end up with somebody who would pay better and have shorter jobs and that kind of thing. But like, you know, I loved it. I loved the freedom of it and the sense, the camaraderie was just ridiculous. I swear to God, to my mind, I've always tried to explain this to students, that I always feel like it's almost like the PALS battalions that went to World War One. Now, I know nobody died, but what I mean is that you felt this incredible, this togetherness that was just ridiculous, and you would do anything for each other. You really were like a band of brothers or brothers and sisters. But, you know, when you got together on Friday evening and you decompressed after the week, the stories and the banter and the fun and the feeling of togetherness was just, I've never experienced that like it. It actually, I was only talking to the wife recently, it probably took me like 10 to 15 years to get over being a bicycle messenger, because nothing, the buzz and the feeling of going to work every day, you cannot find, I don't know. I think there's days when I'm teaching when everything goes really, really well and it's been amazing. But as a courier or bike messenger, you're kind of nearly experiencing that a couple of times a week at least, if not more. And you just feel so, the adrenaline and the buzz is ridiculous. And it actually took me a long time to actually get over it. And, you know, it's not like an addiction, but it's kind of, you know, you kind of nearly, you take a good job and you're very, very happy, but it's almost disappointing compared to what you used to achieve in a day in Dublin. You know, it's hard to explain, but that's the way I feel. Sorry, I don't know. Your other question, sorry, you're wanting to know about, like, you know, the YouTube videos and stuff like that. I think, first of all, is it must be incredible to have the confidence that young people have today. Like, I was a green guy starting back then, and you know, kind of, I didn't feel like I belonged. And whereas now you have people who are at the age of 21, they just rock up and they probably strap on a GoPro and off they go, and they video something crazy going on every day. And I really admire that kind of confidence and stuff. I didn't have that, but I also think today a lot of the stuff that they film on GoPro, I think GoPros unfortunately are a safety mechanism. People have to have it, particularly in London. I'm sure you've seen the videos where people, you know, you end up confronting drivers, or you end up having to record a stupid mistake because a van might, you know, run you over or whatever. And if you're not recording, you know, literally it never happened. People don't believe. So from that point of view, but I think in terms of following somebody on YouTube, that will be incredible. Like I said, unfortunately, probably 10% of the week is exciting, and the other 90% is not on the video, you know, that kind of way. But I just think particularly, like, when I was careering, there was the Messenger World Championships on, so really, you know, really highly contested kind of competition. I think one of the years I was there was in Denmark, and they had like 1,000 couriers. People came from all over, you know, America included, came over to compete against each other. So they were really, really top notch. And I imagine if GoPro was around back then, or videos, that would be absolutely incredible. I can imagine getting into the buzz of it. I got a GoPro myself this year, and I just used it on the mountain bike, and I just you know, it's addictive, you know, because you're watching a 10-second clip and it's like, oh my God, did that really happen? You know, it's incredible. So in Dublin or as a courier, it must be amazing to watch that. I suppose like the New York guys are crazy, but there's a very high death rate as well. So, you know, from that point of view, you know, it's crazy watching. And also there's even a couple of documentaries. I think there was one called A Murder of Couriers, I think it was, made a few years ago. There's been a few anyway, but like it's a culture. It's a huge thing. Whereas back when I was starting, I think we were kind of forgotten. And also I think there was a lot more respect. I don't mean, it sounds like a contradiction. What I mean by forgotten is that people didn't even know your average pedestrian didn't even know couriers existed back then. Whereas there's so many bikes and so many people cycling today. Everybody's with their bike to work and all that kind of thing is on the roads. And so there's a lot more cyclists out there. Cyclists back then were probably forgotten in that they just kind of disappeared off down laneways, and they weren't distinctive, and they weren't an actual moving culture, if you know what I mean. And also, I think I might be wrong, but I thought at the time there was a lot more respect for messengers or for cyclists in the city, in that at the time, because it was pre-internet, you know, everybody knew, like a taxi driver or a bus driver in the city, they knew that you need a bike messenger. They were actually important. They were probably as important as a taxi driver, because you were delivering documents or whatever across the city at all hours of the day. And there were important things, you know, like particularly legal documents and stuff like that. Or, you know, one time I ended up with a stool sample. Sorry, I hope you're not disgusted, but I ended up having to bring a stool sample from, I think it was a guard station to a solicitor's. And I still no idea to this day. Well, I mean, when I went in to pick it up, like, I was like, what? But it was obviously legally, there was some reason for this to be moved from one place to the other. I have no idea why. But like, you know, even then, you like, even though that was really bad, you actually felt like you were actually doing something important, because you were in the forecourts, you were in solicitors, you were helping offices, that kind of thing. But I think that that's kind of been watered down or diluted. And also the amount of cyclists on the road now has meant that your GoPro is probably a very sensible thing to have, you know, because you need to protect yourself. And I don't think drivers have the respect or the courtesy anymore. It's probably just sheer numbers, I think. You know, because they've, for example, in Dublin, they've dropped the speed limits. I think it's 30k an hour is what you're allowed in the city centre. If you're a taxi driver, that's going to annoy the bejesus out of you. Whereas if you're a cyclist, that's the speed you're going all day long. So actually, you know, you kind of now you people actually won't like you as much as they used to like you before. But I think, like, I'd love to have videoed some of the stuff. But then, like I said, I think 90% of the time, I wouldn't have had anything to watch. You know, there wouldn't be anything to show. I think it's a safety thing now. But also, I think anybody who's got content for YouTube, they must be, you know, they're really good at their job, and it's highly exciting to watch. All right.
Well, I would say so much information that you gave us, John, and a really complete picture of what life was like as a career. And I think it's surprising, I guess, because, you know, nowadays you see like so many riders, well, even in Spain we call them riders, you know, with all the like fast food and all the deliveries, like Uber Eats and all these things. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time it's a really precarious you know, way of life, and it's not just how they're looked at, it's just actually the conditions, and, you know, so it's something very close to us that I think, you know, we can relate to, but of course, even down to what you were saying about the streets, and you're working as if you were a taxi driver, and then nowadays, you know, you would just get your mobile out and just put like Google Maps or whatever. So that just makes me think, you know, how much things have changed really, since the 90s, for example. And then even like, in the 90s as well, like you lived in Spain, I believe. So, obviously I was here too as a native. But I would be interested in knowing, you know, from your point of view, what it was like to live there, to live in Spain.
Ooh. Okay. Yeah, I don't know. It's a tough time. Like, I mean, first of all, I ended up in Spain by accident. I think our friend Mike Ling, who I would have grown up with back in New Ross in County Wexford, we were in school in the 1980s. He was kind of living the dream in the 90s, in that he did Spanish in college, and he ended up in South America and did kind of traveled around and then came back to Madrid, I think in the mid 90s. And then obviously we were in touch by telephone, which, because it wasn't mobiles back then. So we occasionally, and actually, yeah, Mike was actually a good letter writer. So we used to write letters to each other. And it turned out then that over one summer, 1997, I'd finished my college degree in 96, and I was still working as a bike messenger, and I said, geez, I can't keep doing this. And also, I had a degree, but I wasn't doing anything with the degree. So Mike actually suggested, listen, man, why don't you come over to Madrid and try teaching, because at least, you know, you've got English. I had English and history in my degree, so I could try teaching and see how it went. And, you know, to be fair, Mike made it very, very easy for me. I ended up coming over in mid-September. I was I used the word green a while ago. Oh my God, like Madrid. If you know Dublin, Dublin city centre is terribly small, really, compared to any other city. You know, I lived in Dublin. I lived within a kilometre or so of 1 to 2 kilometres of Dublin city centre for all the time I lived in Dublin. And, you know, it was cheap. Your local pub was the pub that all the tourists went to, and everything was cheap and very easy to live with. And then I arrived in Madrid, and it's probably 4 times the population, and everything. We don't have a metro, or we don't. To be fair, we still don't have any sort of decent logistics when it comes to public transport. So I was like, oh my God, where have I ended up? And you know, Madrid was crazy, and you know. It's obviously it's very, very big. So everything is outsized in the 90s. So I suppose realistically, I arrived because we'd arranged it by letter, which is, you know, mad when you think of it today. Also, Mike had just moved in with his now wife at the time into a place, but he had invited me out, so I ended up sleeping on his couch for the first 2 to 3 weeks, I think it was. And he never said a word, and I didn't realize they'd literally just moved in together. He was so kind. And I slept on the couch, and then ended up getting accommodation with a couple of other people that are still friends with Mike, as far as I remember. A Scottish guy called Lindsay and an English guy called Will, and we ended up living together in an apartment or whatever. But look, 90s back then was crazy. I assume a lot of it's the same. In terms of teaching, you found out by word of mouth or by a poster in an English school what was available. Same to try and find accommodation. You didn't have the internet, so you took a slip of paper with a phone number on it and you rang it and you phoned it to see if you could get accommodation or try and find flats and stuff like that. It was everything you wanted to do. You wanted to go to cinema was take out the, I can't remember what the, there was a guia that was around every week or every 2 weeks and stuff that told you what was on. So you went through that to see what was in the cinema, all that kind of thing. The thing that struck me the most was I used to smoke for a couple of years. And when I got over there, it's hard not to smoke in Spain, simply because I think I came out of the, is it Colón? I think it was. And I walked up and there was across the road, it had this huge scaffolding. It was being refurbished, and the whole scaffolding was covered in this gauze or cloth with a gigantic camel on it. And the camel had was its tail was on fire and it was heading for the ground. But the camel was like 10 stories high, and underneath was never throw a lighted camel out the window or something like that. You're nearly forced to smoke in every place you went. There was smoke and advertisement every metro, every place at all. It was crazy. What was the other thing was, I assume it's the same. You got a lot of, back then was a lot of, I suppose, culture shock. Because you had your underground, there was a lot of buskers, that kind of thing, a lot of poor people. I remember being there the first winter, and for example, they roast chestnuts. When you come out of the underground, some people still roast chestnuts at the entrance to the underground. And I was like, what is this? And I remember my mum and dad had been in London in the 1950s for their honeymoon, and they spoke of this. So I had to get these chestnuts, and it was just something completely new to me. I was like, it was another world. But I suppose also what comes across is, or what I remember most is how friendly everybody was. And I don't think that's changed, because we go back to Spain every year, and I know it's not the same as living there full time, but once you build up a rapport in your local market, you know, the guy who's cutting you the chicken, he's going to throw a little extra chicken in, or he's going to fillet it like you've never seen chicken filleted before, just because you build up a relationship. Whereas I think Ireland, even back then, was kind of impersonal, and kind of, you know, there wasn't that kind of relationship. You know, I don't ever remember anybody throwing in an extra apple into a bag, you know, in back home or whatever, because they knew you or whatever. It just seems that Spain people kind of build relationships with you no matter what you're doing. And my abiding memory of the 90s was going into the local market. I was living down in Delicias, not far from Atocha, and I remember the market every Saturday, and it got to the point very soon where they knew my name, and you know, they were just so friendly, and I just thought, Jesus, that's so not Ireland, you know what I mean? So it's a distinctive thing. The other thing I laughed was when I came back in 99, I had a laser card, right? And it's no big deal to have a laser card, but it was a big deal when I came back to Ireland, because nobody was using laser cards. You know, Spain, people always, traditionally when I went to Spain, the attitude would be people, you know, the typical stereotypical nonsense of, oh, the Spaniards, they sleep all day and they have siestas. You know, and incredibly, what I found was they work 10 times harder than Irish people have ever worked. And then also when they've got a lunch break, they go and do an English class. So they want to do more and more and more, and they work really, really hard. And, you know, whereas Irish people actually tended to be, I'm not going to say they were lazy in comparison, but, you know, I found Spanish people the total opposite of the typical, stereotypical attitude that people had towards them. And they worked incredibly hard, and then they smiled at you for an hour, and they lapped up everything that you did in English class, and they wanted to know more and more and more. I thought that was, you know, that was a real eye-opener for me. It was brilliant, and how well they would look after you and take care of you. And, you know, if you want, I just thought, you know, they might go for a coffee or something after the class, but they're still working, you know. They were putting in their 8 or 9 hour or 10 hour day sometimes, and then they would do an English class, or they do an English class to come in at 7 o'clock in the morning to do an English class, or stay after work to do an English class. You know, that's, I don't know anybody here in Ireland who would do that today, but you know, that was kind of cool. I think like, say, yeah, the laser car thing was really funny. They were in terms of Spain was way ahead of Europe. I think a lot of European attitude is, oh, Spain is down there and they're not really up to date, whereas it had the best of absolutely everything, and incredible public transport and all this sort of stuff, streets ahead of everybody. And yet it was kind of, because of the Iberian Peninsula, people kind of were, you know, kind of not too pushy about it. I'm totally wrong about it, you know. And so, like, yeah, like a laser card. I came home and I brought the laser card to my local bank and I said, listen, I want to withdraw some money from my account. And the guy, the manager behind the counter in New Ross, said, what's that? And I said, it's a laser card. And he said, what's a laser card? You know, so it was like, it's a bit stupid that people don't realize how advanced Spain was in the 90s. And, you know, because I think the whole Franco thing, everybody thought Spain was kind of, you know, oh, they're only catching up. Actually, there were streets ahead of most people by the time I got there anyway.
It's funny you mentioned the laser card, because I found that when I moved to Spain, everybody was using WhatsApp. And when I went back to Ireland, nobody was using it, and it was really annoying. Because WhatsApp was, is obviously a superior way of communicating when compared to SMS. But yeah, this idea of Spain being backward is a very persistent falsehood. You know, it goes back many years. Even you know, myself and Maria were talking about this the other day. The idea of Spain being different, this tagline was coined by one of Franco's ministers, because he encountered a lot of crazy questions when he was talking to foreigners, again, along the lines of siestas, and did, you know, was Spain Africa? Were there lions in the streets? Did women have guns in their garters? These kind of like old fashioned stuff from even the Napoleonic era, you know? Though, to be fair, in 2013, I was asked by a Spanish girl if we had McDonald's in Ireland. So I guess we're as bad as each other for perpetuating these things. So, you know, obviously you went back to Ireland and, you know, was that a hard change? I mean, was it weird being back? How difficult and how quickly did you make that adjustment back in the old outside again?
I was first of all, I suppose, like, I was coming, when I came back, when I left in 99, I just broke up with a Spanish girlfriend, and the relationship hadn't ended well. And I was on the airplane going home, swearing off anything to do with Spain ever again. I was never going to try to speak Spanish, never going to speak to a Spanish woman, and never going to go to Spain again. All these kind of things. I was probably going to burn my passport when I got home. And it didn't work out that way. I suppose coming back to Ireland was a bit of a mess in, I suppose, mentally for me. I was kind of like, oh my God, because I was coming back once again to no job, whereas I'd actually been working as an English teacher pretty much for the 2 years in Spain. So that was kind of, I was back to square one. But I ended up in a local school. Before we take a look at Ireland, I ended up at the end of that summer my sister spotted an advertisement in the local newspaper, and it was like 5 hours of English teaching in a local school. And I took it because it was either that or go back to Spain. And you know, I thought, geez, I don't know if I should go back to Madrid or what should I do. And then I ended up literally first day I walked into the staff room in that school, and it was here in my own town. And I saw this beautiful girl, and I said, oh my God, she's too beautiful. She won't even speak to me. And it turned out that her name was Marisa. Her mother was from Bilbao, and she was the Spanish teacher in the school, or one of two Spanish teachers in the school. And we fell in love. literally like that. So my transition from coming back from Spain to Ireland was actually helped by the fact that basically I just met another Spaniard, really, or pretty much half Spanish anyway, which was a bit of a mess. And I remember walking around in circles in September going, oh my God, she's like, there's a Spanish connection, I can't deal with a Spanish connection. But actually it was a really fantastic Spanish connection from my point of view. Look, it come back into Ireland, I mean, things started to change. Celtic Tiger kicked in before I left for Spain in 97. So the building trade was starting to go up and you could buy a house. I'll tell you a stupid story. I suppose I'm not too up to date with all these things, but in 1995, I'd started working as a bike messenger in 95. And I think it was that summer, because it was a particularly nice summer. By the end of 1995, I was earning... I can't even remember what I was earning, but I walked into the bank in Baggot Street to deliver a package, and I was a bike messenger. I was covered in sweat, covered in diesel fumes, dirt, looked shocking, looked like somebody just beat me up. Walked in and I was getting the assistant manager to sign off on a letter before I handed it over, and the assistant manager kind of said, are you interested in a mortgage by any chance? Now, I mean, if I walked into a bank, I wouldn't give me a mortgage. I looked horrendous. And this guy was like trying to sell me a mortgage, and he said, how much do you earn? Now, I can't remember what I earned at the time, but maybe it was like, say, between 200 and 300 pounds a week or something like that. And he said, oh, we could make that work. Now, this is 1990, I think it was 95, late 95, and I was kind of going, how can you make that work? And he was basically, there was ways around it, but basically by the time I left, I was supposed to be delivering a letter. After 10 minutes, he was basically telling me that I could afford a £35,000 mortgage at the time. Now, in today's money, that's, you know, nothing. But £35,000 in 1995 would buy you a house in Ringsend. And there's no house in Ringsend for less than €500,000 now. So things were getting going when I left the country, and I was thinking, I'm too young to buy a house, I'm not responsible enough, all this sort of thing. So my biggest mistake, I suppose, was not actually realizing that the country was starting to take off. So when I came back from Spain a few years later, didn't buy a place, and when I ended up in Spain in 97, came back in 99, and then realized if I didn't get on the property ladder very, very quick, things were going to go wrong. Prices were starting to go up and up and up. So got a house here in my local town with my wife. I'm very, very lucky, but at this point, if you didn't jump on a house, the prices were just going up and up. The developers were going bananas. They were building on absolutely everything. I heard a story only recently, and it was actually a guy who I would have hung out with back then, but he was involved in building. And he went to a wedding in, I think it was, so it was, wasn't 2000, 2001, so not long after I came back. But he went to a wedding in 2001, and this guy there was a whole bunch of developers at this wedding, and they were sitting at a particular table, and this guy took out a box of Cuban cigars, which in Ireland back then was still, you know, rare and whatever. But he took out a lighter, and instead of lighting the cigar with the lighter, he lit a 50 euro note and lit the cigar with the 50 euro note. And then everybody at the table did the same thing, because the developers were making so much money at that time that they could basically just throw money away. And he absolutely swears that this happened. He said he was there and he wasn't doing as well as they were, but he actually felt obliged to take a 50 euro note out of his wallet and pay for or to light a cigar. But he said that's the sort of money and change that had happened. And then obviously over the next few years, things went bananas, crazy up to 2008. But like in the early 90s, it was get on the ladder. I suppose the banks drove it as well. You know, I mean, my brother-in-law, for example, would have been offered, he bought a house near Dolphins Barn, and it wouldn't have been the best part of town, and the house wasn't in great condition. He was in full-time employment, but paid very poorly. And they offered him a mortgage for 300,000 or something euros at the time, himself and his partner. So they took it and bought the house, and you know, but like banks were literally throwing money at people. I remember having my first proper full-time secondary job. It was a credit union, and they used to leave little leaflets. They used to walk into a school, put leaflets on the staff room table and walk out again. And the leaflet was basically a loan application. You just filled out this one A4 sheet with your name, how much you wanted. And they gave you tick the box between, say, you know, 1,000 or whatever, but you literally tick the box. And then, and you left your phone number, and they phoned you back. And by the end of the day, the money was in your account if you wanted a loan, because they knew you were, at that time, if you're a teacher, a nurse, a guard or whatever, they were literally throwing money at you and they didn't care how you were going to pay it back because they had you. But there was that much money floating around back then. It was a little scary. And obviously, look, we know how that all ended up. But at the time, geez, I don't know what to call it. You know, for me, it wasn't necessarily Ireland was changing when I left Spain, but it had utterly changed by the time I came back. And I actually found it hard to, you know, it's not to catch up, but like, you know, look, it caught up with everybody, didn't it? In 2008, I mean, it blew up. You know, everybody who was in the trades lost their jobs, basically, and it was fairly tough going. But you know, at the time, I found it hard to keep up with the whole thing. I thought, geez, what's going on here? And I'm not smart. Was myself and my wife realized that, you know, we bought our house in, we put the deposit down in 2002, and we got in there just on time, really. And you know, where I live, our house has doubled in price over the next 3 years. So we were lucky to get the mortgage we did, and also to get a tracker mortgage. You know, banks started talking people out of tracker mortgages and stuff like that. But then we were incredibly lucky to get what we got. But you know, give it two, 3 years, it went nuts. And the problem is, I still don't understand to this day, or nor my wife doesn't either, why people fell for it. You know, we have friends who bought houses that they just could not afford. And then in 2008, their houses were, well, not valueless, but worth one third what they were going to have to pay for the next 25 years. And we knew this, and we could see this coming from the mid-noughties, and never understood why people would just keep on doing it. But they did. And you know, I'm not going to say that when things blew up, it's our fault, but you know, Irish people have to take a little bit of responsibility for it. I mean, the banks were literally throwing balls of money at you, but at the same time, it was up to you whether you wanted to actually take it or not. And you had to know at some point that there was going to be payback.
No, you're completely right. Listening to your story, there's no surprise why the arse fell out of the whole thing, basically. You know, I mean,
yeah, literally, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm shocked by the fact that there are smoking cigars and lighting with 50s. I think it's somebody who's seen, you know, a movie and they're replicating that in real life. It's you know, it's pathetic, really, that kind of action of smoking cigars like that. But fascinating though, because you know, I grew up in the 90s in terms as a child, so I wasn't thinking of mortgages, let alone tracker mortgages. Though I do remember the advert on TV, which is very iconic in Ireland. You probably know it, Joe. What's a tracker mortgage? Do you remember that one when someone's on the bus?
No, I don't.
Do you remember that? No. Maybe we'll put the link in the description for people who are interested in some kind of Irish culture there.
I don't know what a tracker mortgage is.
I don't know how to save money on my car insurance.
I don't understand APR.
Excuse me. What's this ad for?
Financial regulator.
If you've got a question about personal finance, just log on to the financial regulator's.
But you mentioned you're a teacher as well, and I just wanted to get your ideas about being a teacher, because cooking the dinner, I have RT Radio 1 on the Alexa, I listen to Claire Byrne or Pat Kenny, and it comes up from time to time that people are talking about reforming the Leaving Certs or banning homework, it's not good for kids and all that jazz. Just from your perspective, as a teacher in modern day Ireland, what are the, I guess, the challenges facing you? Is there a need for reform in some areas? What would you say about that, really?
Geez, I know. Well, first of all, yeah, I am a teacher in modern Ireland, but I'm not a modern teacher. So I'll put that in there. I'm 54. I'm as sour as it gets. I think that things have changed. Look, first of all, you guys are, you know, if you're teaching English, for example, now it's pretty much online, as far as I know, isn't it? I think or that's the way it's going, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, so like the problem is, like, I think with COVID, it changed things an awful lot. Like, yeah, okay, like the Leaving Cert does need to be changed, and I think Ireland is, it always kind of does what England does, and then sometimes it rolls back on itself. So, for example, at the moment, the Junior Cert that's being introduced across the board is the same as the Junior Cert the equivalent of what happens 15-year-olds in England. But having said that, in England, they've realised that it's not working properly, and they've started to roll back and go back the way that they were. And what happened was, unfortunately, Ireland is going to follow that way. It always follows on. It's going to go back. It'll change. At the moment, because I think COVID had a huge amount to do with it, the whole idea really is that it's there's a big center on well-being, like an awful lot of hours. I'm not too sure how many hours are spent on each subject in junior cert, for example. So it's like it's 300 to 400 hours are spent over a year on a subject, for example. But what happens is the department has decided now to do well-being, that they're taking hours away from. So for example, my wife teaches, I think it's first year, second year, third year Spanish. So in first year, she's got two Spanish classes. Okay. And that's only 40 minutes a week, right? Which is not enough to get a kid interested in Spanish. And what happened was she lost the class because there's a kind of a mindfulness angle or a culture of kind of well-being that's been in there. So hours have been taken away from everybody's subject in order to put well-being in instead. Now, that's okay. The only problem is that when they get to the end of third year, they haven't spent enough time on the topic. So what happens is their well-being is actually affected anyway, you know, as in they're going to be more stressed realistically. But if they'd spent an extra class a week doing it, it would have probably benefited them a little bit more. But also, for example, teachers then are obviously trying to cram three classes a week into two, which is causing, I suppose, conflict. Now, look at that will probably change in a couple of years' time. The leave cert, however, well, first of all, okay, from my point of view, I don't know if I teach the same way. I'm not huge in technology because of the subjects that I teach, English and history. An awful lot of stuff is the lads get a lot of PDFs on subjects, on topics. They get little short snips from YouTube, for example, looking at specific aspects of history, that kind of thing. But generally, I'm kind of stuck in a half a kind of chalk and talk kind of world and a half a technology kind of world. And then, but for example, their homework is sent to me on Teams and I correct it that way. So there's kind of a lot going on. But those guys, I feel, they're the guys that came out the end of COVID. So the guys who I have in 50 or 60 year now, the 16, 17 year olds, are the people who did 3 years of COVID. And I think technology, everything is technology from now. They went online and I don't think they've ever come off it. And it doesn't sound like an addiction, but I think that the problem is that I think you need human interaction. And the way that the course is at the moment, there's so much work on the course that you don't have the time to interact with students as much. Now, I actually take time out of my week and I'm always trying to do stuff. I try to talk. First of all, I suppose my approach in the classroom is to talk to the lads. I assume my wife is exactly the same. It's kind of talk to the lads on their own level, like talk to them like they're adults. And therefore they kind of feel there's a connection there because, you know, so much is online and so much is done through the internet now that actually they've disconnected and don't think, they can communicate as well. I think this, it's down to COVID, really. I think their communication is no longer as good as it was. So if you took the group of guys who probably have just left school, their communication skills would have been a whole lot better because they talked through everything. Whereas, you know, you've got a cohort there who spent on and off quite a few lockdowns disconnected because even though they're in class and they're online, they're not connected. They're not interested. It's impossible to teach a class of 25 or 30 boys, a topic and all of them to get that information and to get something out of it. So technology has kind of gotten in the way, I think. And what happened was, you know, telephones anyway or mobile phones, they rely on technology a lot for just for entertainment. And then, as you know, what we've done in our school, for example, is we banned mobile phones. You're not allowed. They can bring them into school. They stay in the bag. If they're taken out, they're confiscated. And so from 9 to 4. So you can be on your phone at 5 to 9 and you can be on your phone at 4:05. But in between, no, you can't. And it's made a huge difference to the students. But like I would see that as a bigger thing than the actual leaving cert. My only other thing I think is that I think England has it right when it comes to senior students. I think that Ireland I suppose there's two things wrong. One, a Polish friend of mine, for example, and you know, they're very good. I'm not sure what the situation is in Spain, but I know that in Poland, for example, we have a lot of Polish students that at a certain point they decide if they're going to go down the technological route or they're going to go down the academic route, and they either go to that kind of college or they go learn a trade. And I think in Ireland, considering the dearth of tradesmen at the moment, you know, it's a very bad situation here. The reality is that there's still an attitude toward that looks down on tradesmen. And the reality is, you know, every time I run into a past pupil who's a tradesman, they're always driving a better car than me. They always live in a bigger house and they always have a smile on their face. So, you know, it drives me mad that we still have that kind of very old school way of looking at things. You know, my dad was a tradesman and he managed to put myself and my two brothers and one of my sisters, all of us through university at some point. He paid for my first term in college to get me going because I was on the dole and I was broke back in 1992. And after that, but he'd managed to get the rest of the family through university, even though he was a tradesman. And I always thought there was some silly attitude in Ireland that, you know, oh, trades, I don't know. You know, but the reality is that there's something to be said for it. And Ireland really needs to change its attitude towards that. Now, I do see guys in school over the last couple of years head in that direction, but not enough of them. I think that's one thing that has to change. But I think that's a seismic shift in Ireland's attitude rather than educational attitude. The other thing I do think, though, is that you turn a lot of people off school, you know, by having them, they have to sit six subjects minimum in the leave cert. And I mean, there isn't, you know, if you're mathematically good, there isn't enough subjects, for example, for you to do all mathematical subjects, six of them. And so really, you should only have to do two or three and do well at that, and college should still be available to you. You know, England has that right and it's been doing that for decades, whereas we just don't want to go that far. And really, I think that's the biggest change that has to go in there. You turn people off school because there's probably out of the six subjects that they have to do, there's two that they don't really want to be there, but they have to do it anyway because they want their points for college. Whereas I think actually what they should do is narrow down to, you know, three maybe or four. And, you know, so people go to college on 400 points rather than 600 points, but they go there probably doing exactly what they want to do and you know, what makes them happier or what they're very, very good at. And that would make a big change in people's lives, because I think that at one point that I hear recently, I think in one university in Ireland, the first year dropout rate is like 20%. So they don't like the course because they got the points, but they went there because they got the points, not because they're doing subjects or whatever that they liked, and then they have to drop out. So that from my mind, you know, something really has to change. You have to be sending people, if they want to go to college, you have to send them to college doing what they really like and what they're good at. Or simply, if somebody's really good with their hands, there's no point in trying to go to university when you're actually better off doing a trade. And, you know, you will be, in the long run, you'd be better off, probably way better off than the person who went down the academic route.
Well, you have a lot of insights, Joe. You should be able to fix the entire issues of Irish education. But no, it's really interesting to hear your point of view. Obviously, as well, like, you know, you've taught here, you've taught there, and even if there is at school, I suppose, like, traveling also, like, you know, really influences everything you do. And you have a lot of strengths to your boy. You've told us about being a courier. You've told us about, you know, being a teacher in both countries. And you obviously have a lot of insights. So do you think, like, traveling has really influenced you? And, you know, because, like, another thing that you are is a writer as well. You love writing. So, you know, do you think that all those experiences that you're telling us about in both countries have also influenced you when it comes to writing?
Yeah, I guess so. I think, look, first of all, Spain hit me like a hammer. You know, for example, I'll tell you how I'm pretty ignorant. I there's a lot of things I didn't know, particularly when I went to Madrid. And, you know, I'd never heard of Ernest Hemingway. This is how stupid I am. I did an English degree. I'll tell you a funny story. That's a story against myself first. How stupid I am. When I was a bike messenger and I was in college, I was doing an English degree, and this is God's truth. Seamus Heaney was obviously, you know, Nobel Prize winner. And in 1995, he'd won the Nobel Prize, and he was living in Dublin. And he was living in a square. I think it was, oh my God, there's two beautiful squares that are near the Aviva Stadium. I think it's Havelock Square and another square. I can't remember. But anyway, Joe was going around as a bike messenger, and he had a delivery. And the delivery was for, I don't know what the name was. It wasn't Heaney. But I ended up, I was in college at this particular time. I was studying Heaney, right? So our lecturer I think it was a Tuesday and a Thursday night, our lecturer was going on about Heaney for the last few weeks. We're looking at Irish poetry and whatever. And and this was great, and I found the whole college aspect of Heaney fantastic. He was just such an interesting character. So probably next day I was given a delivery to, I think it was Havelock Square, and arrived down to this beautiful square. I thought it was absolutely beautiful, and I was mad busy. It could have been like, I don't know what day of the week, but it was crazy busy. And I was looking at my signature sheets, and I was trying to get things done. So I knocked on the door, and I was, you know, looking at all the signatures and trying to get the work done. And this fella opened the door, and I just handed him the envelope, and I didn't look up initially. I just looked up, but then looked down again. And then I realized, oh shit, that's Seamus Heaney. And I literally handed him the envelope, right? And I was like, this is how stupid I was. And I said, you're Seamus Heaney. And he said, I am. And it was really nice. And I said, you're not going to believe this, but I'm studying you in college right now. And he just laughed. And he was, oh, and he was very, very polite. But I was crazy busy. And then I was like starstruck. I was like, Jesus, I don't know what to say to this guy. So he was just super, super friendly. And his wife came out behind him sort of thing. And he said, I think this is for you. Sorry, listen. And I said, listen, I got to go now. And he said, no problem at all. Nice to meet you. And he was super friendly, right? But that's how if you like, ignorant I was, right? So when I end up in Spain a few years later, obviously, like, I don't know if you do read Ernest Hemingway, but like, I only found out about Ernest Hemingway when I came back from Spain, right? Like, Ernest Hemingway writes about Spain he just brought it alive for me. So when I came home from Spain, like, I was reading this and I was going, oh my God, I have to go back to Spain again. And I did. And I realized that what he was writing about, even like say in the 1930s during the Civil War about, in For Whom the Bell Tolls, mother of God, he could nail Spanish people. He just had their culture, their way of going on, could be from, you know, having a drink to whatever, but he was just, it's just incredible how he could do this. So, and I realized there and then, two things, I suppose. One is that, I needed to read more. And the other one was that, you know, realistically, he only ever wrote, his best books were written about things that he saw himself or did himself. So, like, look, I know, bullfighting is not a great topic or whatever, but at the time it was a huge thing when he was writing in the 20s. So, like, his writing on bullfighting was incredible. And his writing on Spanish Civil War, it's marvelous. You know, I don't have to tell you that. But, like, the idea is that he was there, he saw it, he was a war correspondent during the Civil War. Look, I know he spent a lot of time probably drunk in a hotel in Madrid, but at the same time, he was in the war and he wrote about what he saw. And that's, I realized then, God, you have to write about what you know about, what you've seen. So I suppose, realistically then, for me, travel was a big thing. Spain, you know, I got around to a lot of the corners of Spain, and then when I came back, these things stuck in my head. And I guess, yeah, I'm doing a bit of writing, and I think Madrid in particular really stuck in my mind. And also it was the people and the frenetic pace of life sometimes. Just like, you know, you walk into a pub in Ireland and somebody will slap you on the back and you might have a pint and there's a quiet chat. I never found that in Spain. I always found people full of life and really, you know, moving all the time. But if you didn't go to Spain, you'd never know that. Or, you know, that kind of, that just effervescence that they have, it's just, you have to experience. And so if you're an Irish person and you go on, I don't know, a holiday to the Canaries or something like that, you're not going to experience that because you're surrounded by other expats, really. Whereas, you know, if you're part of something in Spain or I assume any other country, it just, you know, it comes alive for you. And then when you go home, you can write about it because you actually saw that with your own eyes, or you said that, and it works that way. And I think travel is a huge thing. I remember there's two places in particular, I suppose. Spain, obviously, I can't get enough of Spain. Back every year and I find something, there's always something new or something different. I have a couple of Spanish friends and they really bring out the whole, I don't know, they just, it's like being on drugs. You know, no matter how long you're there, it's, everything keeps coming at you, and it's just life is lived in Spain. I know it's probably, you know, the grass is always greener and all that, but I just, even when I'm talking to my friends, it's just there's a little bit more there, you know. And I'm not going to compare them to Irish people. I just think Spanish people, there's a particular way. And but you don't know that unless you're there. And same thing, I was in Tunisia years ago, but I was only there for a short while. But it just really hit me, like, this place, like, this is kind of, you know, where the Romans lived, and you're walking around Colosseums in the desert and stuff like that, and it's like something out of a movie set. And then you go home and you go, oh my God, I have to write that down, you know. So I think I think travel really influences, definitely influences writing, but just influences the way you think, you know. Like, for example, you know, when you come back from Spain and you say no at the end of the sentence, you know, we don't do that in Ireland, and people are kind of like, what? And but then you get used to it. Or the whole handshake thing. Jesus, like, Irish people are still afraid to shake your hand. You know what I mean? Like, but like, if you go to, or I remember, for example, I'd come back from Spain and I ran into my friends and people I'd gone to college with. And what you call it? You know, obviously you're going to give them two kisses because that's what everybody in Spain does all the time. And one of the first girl that I'd gone to college with and ran into her and I went to give her two kisses and she said, Jesus Christ, what are you doing? You trying to snog me? I was like, no. But I was like, the whole thing is like, to be fair, she traveled a bit, but she never really got into that. And she's like, but these are things that you don't know unless you go someplace else. So like when I write, I suppose I try to put things down that I saw or things that people do that are different, because otherwise, you know, you're not really writing something interesting. You have to make a whatever world your story or your blog or your novel is based in. You have to bring that into it. You have to make that come alive. And, you know, I was saying there's some places just do that for you. It's impossible. Like Tunisia is, for example, you know, you're driving along first thing in the morning, you're on a bus and you're passing by the local butchers, and the local butchers is where they've taken a goat and they've cut it open, hung it from a tree and they've cut it open. And the earlier you get up, the better the meat is. And as the day goes on, obviously the meat is not as good. And that's the local butchers. But like, you know, you have to see that, and you have to be able to try to write that, then bring it back, because people, you know, people wouldn't even believe that happens, you know. And that, so seeing these things kind of is so vivid and whatever that you kind of feel obliged to nearly write it down. So it definitely does, what do you call it? It makes me want to write, you know. And also, I think that there's a holistic approach to writing that, like I've been on and off in Spain pretty much, what, 20, to be fair, bar 2 years during COVID, since 1997, I've been in Spain every year. And the whole idea is that all those experiences, when you go to write down, there's a holistic approach to how you write. Like, you may not have seen something, but something is in the back of your mind. It's in your hard drive that you've had for years that you remembered. And then it comes out and you put that into a paragraph or whatever, along with something that you only saw maybe a couple of weeks ago. But it's real, and it makes it readable because it's just real, you know. Whereas I feel that you can have people who decide to write on a topic, but they're never going to make that come alive because they haven't been there, or they haven't seen that, or they haven't spoken to that person. So I think travel is you have to travel, you know. And I think Irish people, it's very funny that I teach a lot of students now who they're quite happy to get the job in the local area and stick around. But I was kind of going like, man, every Irish person at some point, you know, back in your DNA, probably 150, 60, 70 years ago, probably half your family left the country, you know. And you know, Irish people are, you know, the diaspora is in every corner of the world. Like, and yet I don't understand why people nowadays, well, Irish people anyway, don't want to do that. And I think, like, man, you gotta get out. Even like a year in Australia or whatever, you gotta see another world. You gotta do something, you know, with your life. I don't know. So I think like travel really influenced me. My only downside is that what I found from being in Spain for a little while was that, and I don't know if you guys have ever noticed that, like when you come home and you're no longer Irish. Sorry, in my point of view, like, you know, when I come back to New Ross, it's kind of, oh, you're the fella that was away. And the problem is when you're in Spain, you're not Spanish, are you? Because you're the Irish fella that came here. So there's this kind of thing where it's not that you don't belong, but you're kind of on the periphery a little bit, in that you kind of, you've disconnected from, you're not connected to the place you've moved to, and you're not no longer connected to the place you left, and you're kind of caught in the middle. And I think sometimes people are a little wary about you when you, like for me, when I came back from Spain, it's kind of like, oh, you've been to Spain. And I wanted to talk to them all the time about the culture and the things that I saw and did and people I met. And really, it means nothing to them because they haven't been there. And I found that hard.
Yeah, you think you're being highfalutin, you know? It's like, oh, yeah, back in Spain, you know, so, which can be annoying. But it's interesting you mentioned Hemingway, because I've just finished today, actually, Farewell to Arms, which isn't based in Spain, but a neighboring country, Italy, which for anybody listening, I would recommend. Joe, it's been an absolute education, a pleasure. I could listen to you for hours. You're great at telling stories, lots of interesting details there. And all I can say really just thank you so much for being here. I really, really enjoyed it.
Yes, thank you so much, Joe. It was great.
Well, great. Thank you for having me. I hope I didn't talk too much. It's the only problem.
No. In a podcast, that is fantastic. So don't worry. perfect form for a podcast. All right, guys. Thank you for listening for this episode of the podcast. You can find us on all major platforms and see you in the next episode.